This week we're off to the largest freshwater lake in New South Wales, home once again to thousands of water birds. We meet a young winemaker with a real connection to the earth and get a farm safety message from a travelling UK farmer. Jim Chapman lost an arm in a tractor accident and now wants to spread the word to farmers around the world.
Before you go diving into a situation that might be dangerous, is just to take 10 seconds, take a breath and have a look at what you're about to do before you go jumping into it and make sure that what you're about to do is worth it.
Jim Chapman's story and his farm safety message a little later. But first up today, let's travel to Lake Cowal in New South Wales. When it's dry, farmers graze cattle and grow crops on the lake bed. But when it's full, it's a very different story.
We've just paddled through an area there where you can see some white ibis nesting, using that fresh lignum growth to weave their nests. And we had three eggs in each of the nests, so it looks like they're enjoying the time there.
And it's not just the white ibis that are enjoying their time on Lake Cowal. It's a beautiful day to be paddling across the largest freshwater lake in New South Wales.
So we're listening to reed warblers, Eurasian coots, purple swamp hen mostly.
Hello, I'm Peter Doherty. Lake Cowal is what they call an ephemeral watercourse. It only fills after a significant flood event, and that happened last October when the Lachlan River and the Bland Creek overflowed. And with the water comes the birds, lots and lots of birds. I've jumped in a kayak and I'm following Malcolm Carnegie out on the lake just to see what's here. Is that the warbler?
Yeah. See that one at the back? Look, it's got its plumage out there. Fanned out.
He's a project manager with the Lake Cowal Foundation, a non-for-profit environmental trust which promotes the health of this ecosystem.
They're beautiful, aren't they?
Any birds you're seeing this season that you haven't seen at Lake Cowal before?
Yeah, well, as we came through there and we just stopped partway through there, I noticed there were two Nankeen night herons, which I haven't seen since the last flooding in 2012. It was interesting to see them there, and lots of royal spoonbill around. There's even more here than I saw probably 3 weeks ago, I guess, so that's changed a bit as well.
And the magpie geese, do you usually get magpie geese nesting here, or here at all?
We haven't seen them here for probably since 1990, so that's a bit unusual, I guess. And there's a reasonable number of them here. They've been here since the flooding started. So, but interesting to see them out here in the lignum. Last time I was out here, I didn't see them out here. They were on the edge.
Lake Cowal is about 40 kilometres from West Wyalong in the central west of the state. It's co-owned by local landholders and the resource company Evolution Mining, which operates a gold mine on the western shore. The mining company funded the Lake Cowal Foundation back in 2000 to placate environmental groups which were opposed to its operation.
Lake Cowal itself is New South Wales' largest natural inland lake, so it's very important in terms of scale, but also obviously it's a significant bird breeding area, and it's got some really good examples of this type of habitat that we're in at the moment with the lignum and the river redgum, but also on the edge of the lake there's good banks of cane grass and that sort of thing, which are also important inland ephemeral wetland habitat.
It's an ephemeral lake. Can you tell me a little bit more about how often there are wetlands here?
There's no real average to the way the system operates. As you appreciate, the climate here is highly variable, so we have long periods of dry and then we have fairly intense wet periods like the one we've just been through, so it's a system that changes a lot over time. It can be, usually when the lake fills, it'll have water in it for about 3 years if there's no further runoff. The last major time it was dry from 2001 to March of 2010, you know, that's a 9-year period that it was dry. So it's a very dynamic system, and everything else that lives within it's got to adapt to that.
Is it surreal when you're when it's been in dry for so long and then farmland to be paddling over it?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing to see it dry, and it's just such a barren sort of a landscape when it does, just as it does dry out. And I know in that extended drought period, my son, he was born at the start of that dry time, and he would often come down to the lake with me, and you know, we always referred to it as the lake. But then in 2010, when he was 10 years old, he was just gobsmacked when we drove up and you could see this great expanse of water in front of him. He couldn't understand how that could happen.
I can understand, because I'm finding it really hard to imagine it dry when it's just so much bird life, the trees and what, a metre and a half, 2 metres of water that we've just been paddling through for a half an hour trip out to here in the Ligman.
Yeah, it is amazing. And but I mean, well, for the Lachlan River system and all of the associated wetlands and creeks, it's that's just the way it works. It's everything operates on a boom bust type cycle, and we're in the middle of the boom for it at the moment.
Malcolm Carnegie's not the only one interested in the boom and bust cycles of Lake Cowell. Birdlife monitor Peter Gell from Federation University Australia in Ballarat has been conducting bird surveys here since 1992. He's particularly excited about the magpie geese he's seen this morning.
Finished my survey just before, and we saw 30 adult magpie geese, and delightfully we saw 37 goslings, and that's the first recorded breeding this season that I know of from Lake Cowell, certainly in the 25 years I've been coming up here surveying water birds.
Is that a pelican?
Yes, two pelicans. Whiskered terns. Nice male whiskered tern here, adult. We're here at the end of Lake Road, south end of Lake Road, which is one of the four transects we take. and we generally walk about 2.5 kilometres over an hour and a half or 2 hours or so, surveying as much as possible all the birds that we see along the way. And then one day we get out in the boat and we look to see what birds are breeding amongst the lignum and the red gum in the north and the west of the lake.
Well, you've been taking the same route for the last 25 years around this lake?
That's right. This is my groundhog day. It's come back to the same site and see the same birds every time. So I think they know me by now, many of them, but you know, I certainly know them. And quite often the same birds pop up in exactly the same spot that you saw a year ago or even 2 or 3 years prior. So you also get lots of surprises as well. Certain things turning up unusually due to both local conditions but also conditions elsewhere across eastern Australia. As I said, if it's really dry somewhere else, then birds will come here. It'll be a bit of a magnet. And so there's a great egret further up there. The great egrets are a worldwide species.
Have you noticed any significant patterns over 25 years?
Yes, well, we've witnessed 3 or 4 filling and drying cycles. And it took us 1 or 2 of those to start picking up a regular pattern. There's a suite of birds that will come in at the first filling, and we're seeing those here now with the big floods from last October. So white-necked herons and musk duck, quite often great crested grebe come in the early phase, and then you'll get dabbling ducks will come in, and slowly you'll get more of those birds that feed on small fish and then larger fish. The pelicans usually take a while to come in after first filling. And then on the receding end, you start to get, as it gets shallower, great stretches of shallow water in which there are various wading birds like stilts. There's some snipe around at the moment, being summer, and the like. And you'll get very large numbers of those, plus avocets and dotterels and red-kneed dotterels as well in the shallows. And then it recedes right back, and whereupon it actually becomes quite salty. When it's very shallow and a much lesser extent than it is at the moment. So we see them as fairly predictable patterns, plus you get the seasonal variation. So you'll get international migratory birds here, like sharp-tailed sandpipers, will come in summer. And we've even had double-banded dotterels across from New Zealand in winter. So it expands and contracts dramatically, and ultimately one year I found a pool that was about 10 metres long and about 5 metres wide, and that was Lake Cowell. But other times like this, it's you can see it's a giant freshwater lake, and it's just brimming with water birds and fish, obviously, because the birds, as you can see there, are diving to the surface picking up small fish. And there's a little black cormorant flying past, white ibis, there's more whiskered terns. So yeah, 26 species on this transect this morning. Galahs.
Peter Gell there, busy conducting his bird surveys, and earlier you heard from Malcolm Carnegie from the Lake Cowell Foundation. Peter Doherty was the lucky reporter, allegedly working, but actually just paddling out around the lake. You're with a Country Breakfast, still to come today, visiting Nuffield scholar Jim Chapman and his farm safety message, and we'll meet a young winemaker with a real connection to the earth.
Crazy ideas come to me at 4 a.m. and those are the ideas I think that you need to act on.
Alice Baker is a young winemaker expressing her dreams. At just 30, she's already an assistant winemaker at a small vineyard at Robe on the southern coast in the southeast of South Australia.
I guess I'm a young, energetic, passionate winemaker on a journey to I don't know where.
Hello, I'm Cassie Steith. Alice has always had an affinity with the earth and what it produces. At first she was interested in geology, then it was viticulture. Now her attention is firmly on winemaking, producing something that really reflects her personality.
I started, my first degree was in geology, geophysics, because I was always a kind of pretty outdoorsy kind of gal. So I knew I wanted to do something that kind of connected me to the land, and I thought that was geology, but the reality of actually working in that industry was obviously less than my expectations. I went back to uni, to Adelaide again, and studied the graduate diploma of Oenology and Viticulture, and yeah, that kind of brought me up that one more level up to the ground surface, you might say, to the vines and viticulture. And the vines and viticulture I think are one huge aspect, but I think I'm really more interested in winemaking once the grapes are in the winery. Winemaking has so much more to offer in that it's very scientific. There's the connection to the earth and where the grapes are grown and climate. And now I work, obviously, locally coming to the region. That's my first full-time winemaking job. I work as the assistant at Norfolk Rise Vineyard. It's about 1,700, 1,000 tonne. Depending on the year. It's been awesome seeing how the grapes grow down here and the effects of the ocean, the bonny upwelling, which is a huge influence, the wind is a huge influence, and just the, you know, the regionality. I mean, McLaren Vale's a region, but it's only 40 minutes from Adelaide, whereas we are just in the middle of nowhere, really, here. We're kind of halfway between Adelaide and Melbourne, and it's just really different culturally.
So tell me about what you've been able to do over the last year or so.
So I've just about 6 months ago, bottled my first wine, my first of my own wines, which I called Frida, after Frida Kahlo, the famous Mexican artist, because she's someone that just resonates so strongly with me. She has so many awesome things, and even though she's dead, obviously, you need role models. It was great. It was fun. Made it in the shed here on the site, which I didn't think would work, but it did. It got through primary and secondary fermentation completely unaided, and the colour of it is gorgeous. The smell is gorgeous, and the flavours I just love. I'm just so happy that it turned out. Really? It's a miracle. It's a vintage miracle. So yeah, this is where we made the first wine, Frida. So we got this little press here, this gorgeous old Italian press from an old guy in McLaren Vale who had made it. And it's an awesome press because it's quite old and small and it doesn't actually work very well, but it's good because it only pushes out about 50% extraction from the grapes. in, you know, a commercial winery, that's the best. That would all go into the premium product, and then the harder you press, the worse quality the juice becomes, and that's kind of put into those lower range products. But we can't even get that harder pressed juice out, so we have no lower quality. We only have the creme de la creme, which is bad in a recovery sense from your product, but good for quality.
In terms of your visions for what you want to grow, what's your, I suppose, visions for the future?
Yeah, I guess that's really hard, isn't it? I don't know. It's so hard to know where you're going. It was easy to just make that first wine and just see if it would work. But now it's like, well, I can do that. Now what? I could do any kind of wine, any style of wine. I guess it's just about wines that are interesting. In my cooking, I always like to try something that's sort of crazy or something that challenges, you know, the flavour combinations that perhaps on paper maybe wouldn't work, but somehow you get them to work. It's like defying the odds. And I'd like to follow those kind of same themes with my wine. Just very small, obviously tiny. Last year was one barrel, 2016. 2017 will be one barrel of a similar style, just a little bit more heavy. So last year's wine was quite light. It was a Pinot with white in it. So it was quite an acid-driven wine, very light-bodied and kind of a refreshing, kind of easy, fun wine. For the first year, I didn't want to be too serious. This year, it's like still pretty fun, but slightly more serious. We're going to do Pinot and Shiraz, if it works out. So, yeah, just trying something different every year.
There's a big steer, and it pushed this back, and that went flying smack, got me there, knocked me out, and I knocked out, and then went unconscious as my head hit the concrete.
Farmer Mark Wootton's from Hamilton in Western Victoria is showing UK visitor Jim Chapman around his cattle yards. A few years ago, Mark was knocked unconscious by a gate lever after a beast suddenly pushed against it. He's okay now, but it just goes to show how quickly accidents can happen and how dangerous a farm can be.
It was right on my eye.
Yeah.
There, it was, you know, your temple's there.
Yeah.
I didn't lose an eye.
Yeah, you're lucky.
It slowed me down, and I was a bit fearless before that.
Yeah.
At the end of that, I feared more.
Mark is now installing safety devices around the farm to help protect himself and his staff.
When the people that come in here, these guys are taught you always push on your exit side.
Okay.
So if we ever see anyone on that black side,
yeah,
they get a real kick up the arse.
Cool.
So the same in here, so you can always get out.
Yeah.
If you have to.
The guy's a fantastic farmer in every aspect, extremely professional. The health and safety side of it means a lot to him, and it's actually part of his business. It's not an add-on. It's not something that you have to do as well as the business. He makes it a part of it. He sees it as a way of improving performance on the farm. He sees it as a added benefit to the farm. He doesn't struggle to find staff to come and work here because it is a great place to work, both as a massive professional operation, but also because it's a nice place to work because you're not worried about dangerous machinery or whatever else. Your views are taken on board, and I really like that aspect of it.
Hello, I'm Jess Davis. Jim Chapman has good reason to be listening to Mark's story. Back in 2005, he lost an arm in a farm accident. After struggling with depression for several years, he turned his life around with the help of friends and has now become an advocate for farm safety. He's travelling the world as part of a Nuffield scholarship, looking at farm safety practices.
Most of our spray works contract, and I reckon that's probably the most risky thing we do.
Is it?
Is spray. And we've got charcoal filters on the tractors and stuff like that, but yeah, I still reckon.
So in 2005, I had an accident with a tractor. I got too close to the PTO shaft, which was unguarded, and it was like a matter of seconds. It grabbed hold of my jumper, wound me in, and I went over the top of the shaft and landed on the floor, you know, without my left arm, without any clothing on. And in the UK, it was pretty cold at the time, so I also had that to contend with. The HSE, which is like your work safe, wanted to do a project and try and improve farm safety. They wanted a disabled farmer who didn't mind telling their story about how easy it is to have an accident on farm and how it affects your life. And I now go to colleges and universities and talk to ag students about farm safety and how easy it is and to have an accident and how it affects the rest of your life.
So how does Australia stack up when it comes to farm safety? Jim Chapman says Australia has some unique challenges.
The size and scale of farming, or just the country itself, is your biggest asset, but also one of the biggest problems when it comes to farm safety. A lot of farmers, especially out in the bush, as you'd call it, quite often find themselves distant from legislators, from the rest of the world, if you like. They do see it as a them and us. You know, that you've got the city dwellers and then you've got the country people, and I think that's a little bit of a problem. They're sort of left to get on with their own, they're masters of their own destiny. And so if they want to be unsafe and do things that are risky, there's nobody there to tell them that they shouldn't. There's no overarching protection. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I quite like the isolation, I quite like the remoteness, but at the same time, I think it can also be a challenge for you. A lot of the things are obviously very general. So working with animals, working with machinery, quad bikes, all those sorts of things are very common around the rest of the world. The things you guys have got here that we don't have in the UK, one of which is a big orange thing in the sky called the sun, and we don't see it very often in the UK. And so things like skin cancer and you know, make sure you're wearing a hat and long sleeves seem really alien to us in such a hot climate where we'd naturally want to wear shorts and t-shirt. So things like that you have to contend with that we don't. Also, you know, you've got some creepy crawlies, you've got some snakes and spiders here, which we don't have. And again, the isolation, being so far away from a hospital, if something does go wrong, you are potentially hours away from help.
And as you move up, the induction gets more complicated in terms of the complexity of the machine.
Jim Chapman has also spent time in the United States and Canada during his world tour. When he gets back to the UK, he'll write up a report on what he's seen.
The things that I've learned is that farmers are unique types of people, but then we are the same around the world. So what works for one country will work for another. With regard to, you know, attitudes, cultural shifts, and how farmers like to be told what to do. I've learned that farmers like hearing from other farmers. They don't like hearing from organisations such as WorkSafe, WorkCover, or whatever it would be, the decision makers, if you like. We like to hear from our own kind that what works and what doesn't work. I also have found that safety has to be practical. If it's difficult or if it gets in the way of doing another job, you won't do it. So we have to find that balance between what is absolutely 100% safe by the legislators, but also what actually works on the ground. And that needs to be a two-way conversation between us and the powers that be. We need to have that discussion and not be afraid of it, and not be afraid to talk to people like WorkSafe. The one thing that I say to every farmer that I speak to is an accident usually occurs because we're rushing around, the weather's against us, or there's 101 things that have gone wrong that day. And the one thing that I just say to everybody is just take that time out before you go diving into a situation that might be dangerous, is just to take 10 seconds, take a breath and have a look at what you're about to do before you go jumping into it, and make sure that what you're about to do is worth it. It's that balance between needing to get the job done but also being able to come home to your wife and kids afterwards.
Visiting Nuffield scholar Jim Chapman, spreading his farm safe message around the world, and he was speaking with our reporter Jess Davis on a farm at Hamilton in Western Victoria. And you can find out more about Jim and all the other stories you've heard today, just head to our website. There's some really beautiful photos of the bird life on Lake Cowell. Head to abc.net.au/radionational. I'm Edwina Farley, good to be with you for a Country Breakfast today.